Hello, my name is Andrew Heisel, and I am the project director for the Campaign for Healthy Kids. It's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson, but also other funding sources include Save the Children. All Robert Wood Johnson funds, no Robert Wood Johnson funds have ever been used for any sort of lobbying activity. Cool. No disclosures to report. So the Campaign for Healthy Kids is about affecting policy change at the state and local level by working with partners. And we focus on policies that are supported by research. We stand on the shoulders of these individuals and their organizations and others to do our work. Without their support, without their years of doing research and other sorts of legal research, and we would not be able to push these sorts of policies in legislatures and city councils. So we do technical assistance and training, we do subcontracts and direct expenditures, and we also disseminate information and advocacy-focused research. We do these things, essentially what we do is we find folks at the local and the state level who want to do the work, and then we provide them with extra tools and resources trying to identify gaps and filling those gaps. These are where we worked in 2010. I just want to clarify that in Washington State, New Mexico, D.C. and Philly are the states and the cities where we supported a sugary drink tax. So these are the places where we supported local advocates. So I just want to go over quickly Mississippi, D.C. and Philly, some of the key aspects of the campaign that occurred. In all three cases, we were unsuccessful, but I want to go over basically the details of, or just general broad themes of each, and then highlight some of the best practices we learned. Later in the presentation, I'd like to talk about some effective advocacy messages that we've ascertained through our work and also through public opinion polling. So in Mississippi, there was a 2 cent per ounce excise tax with revenue dedicated to anti-obesity programs and education. What was really great about Mississippi was that we had model legislation. We used actually one of NPLAN's model bills, and it had all the components that make it a bona fide public health policy. It was an excise tax, the consumer would have felt the cost, so there would have been a reduction in consumption. And that to us is really, really important. We don't want to support these if there isn't a public health connection. Otherwise, the tax becomes a money grab. It becomes any other sort of funding mechanism, and ultimately that is a powerful argument against passing one of these, as we found in public opinion polling. Also, we were able to get a House appropriations hearing on this bill. In Mississippi, we did not have a chance at passage, and we knew that. But we knew that going to the state with the worst child obesity problem in the country, that we would be able to get a lot of attention. And we did. We got a national AP story out of it, ran across the country, and there's been subsequent stories in trade journals and other newspapers about the Mississippi bill and the courage that the advocates showed in pushing that bill. In Philadelphia, there was not the, as Ian said, they don't have the authority to levy an excise tax. So what we did is, I know the mayor was in close consultation, Mayor Nutter, who proposed it, was in close consultation with advocates. He made sure that the cost would be passed along to consumers through outreach to retailers, and he also put a placeholder in his budget for 2011, should the tax pass, monies would be directed to obesity prevention programs. What was great about Philadelphia was the mayor. He's been a strong proponent for public health for some time now, and he really pushed this bill. He pushed it really hard, and we came within one vote, as Kelly Brownell mentioned. The other thing is, we had a really tenacious lobbying effort there, led by a firm that Save the Children paid for directly, Triad Strategies. That really kept it in play up until the very end. Washington, D.C. was a one ounce per excise tax with revenue to fund the Washington, D.C.'s Healthy Schools Act of 2010. What was great about D.C. Was that we had a great coalition supporting this. The Healthy Schools Act was passed. It created a gold standard for Washington, D.C. public schools for health, healthy environments. And so we had a coalition that existed around supporting that bill that just, we folded them into this. Essentially, because they had passed this law, they wanted the tax to fund it. And that was a great opportunity, because as you know, lots of folks, the more folks you have at the table, the better your position is. For example, just want to show this ad that we ran thanking Councilwoman Che, who was the author. Just imagine if it just said Campaign for Healthy Kids at the bottom. That would have been much less compelling than having all these other organizations, including the environmental organization, Center for Science and Public Interest. So I just want to go over some effective messaging that we've gleaned from some polls that we've done. This is polls of registered voters, and these are the dates that they were conducted. First of all, across the board, people are very concerned about this issue. They are. And this is pretty incredible if you think about it. In Mississippi, 90%, 87% in Philly, and then in DC, 95%. The challenge is that it's really a complex issue because you need to make all these connections between overconsumption of sugary drinks, childhood obesity, increased disease and costs. Then you have to also make the argument that an excise tax would effectively reduce consumption, which would lead to reductions in obesity. Also in the abstract, when you just talk about this issue generally and you say, is this a role for government? Is this a role for individuals? People tend more often than not to say this is more of an individual problem. It requires an individual solution. So this is the challenge, but it's not insurmountable. Whoops, there we go, wrong way. So key messages that we base, and you've heard these actually today earlier, which is really exciting because we're all on the same page. The first one is that there's a market failure in effect here. And when there's a market failure, you need government interaction. Otherwise, the market failure continues and you get really undesirable outcomes, which we're experiencing right now. The second thing is you really want to connect the sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax issue to addressing the problem of childhood obesity. Because believe it or not, it's not intuitive for some people. This is just a breakdown to show you in our Mississippi poll. When we go through the poll, we'd ask on these different issues whether they supported the tax or not. And what you find is what you would probably expect anyways, which is more small-c conservative folks, Republicans, white men tend to be against this. So with keeping that in mind, look at the market failure argument. Essentially, you have costs that are being externalized on U.S. taxpayers. So that really appeals to small-c conservatives. To everybody, really. The disconnect between individual behavior and the full cost is creating this market inefficiency. These externalities are being borne by third parties, and we know that's true because studies have shown that. This is a great argument because it taps into a powerful narrative in America of fairness and personal responsibility. It says because the market's failing, personal responsibility is not in effect. And you need to make this correction so that people as individuals can do the right thing because they know what the costs are on the front end of their actions. And it necessitates governmental action. So addressing the issue of connecting the tax to childhood obesity prevention, there's not an automatic connection with a lot of voters. For example, in the Mississippi poll, we asked the 600 voters, how they felt about closing the budget gap with one of these taxes, and you see the sugary drink tax was relatively low. Now, if you can read this question, I don't know if you can. It says, "Would you support the law if would you support the law if to fund programs to fight childhood obesity?" And what you see in Mississippi is net 52% support. So you went from 34% support to 52% support by simply adding that piece to it. That connection's very, very powerful, and it's why whenever we support a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax at the state or local level, we require that a significant portion of the funds in the instrument that's being proposed be dedicated to fighting childhood obesity. I think I'm running a little ahead of time, which is good, so there'll be more time for questions. But just some other important considerations I wanted to highlight. Drafting legislation, this is critical. What we found is that when you go into a legislature or a state house or a city council, you really need to be wearing the public health hat because you are there on behalf of the public health. And so your policy needs to reduce consumption in and of itself. Even if the funds are not earmarked to prevention, you need to, with a straight face, you need to go in there and say, this is not a revenue producer. Right now, cities and states are going through major budget shortfalls, and in order to have credibility and to distinguish yourselves from any other sort of tax increase, you need to have this kind of a tax that reduces consumption, as highlighted by the past three speakers. Also, you need to dedicate a portion of the funds to the problem. In the same vein, this is a public health policy. Its primary purpose is not a general fund revenue raiser. Therefore, dedicate a portion of the funds to address the problem in the bill that you propose. Another really important consideration is to build strong coalitions. with diverse partners. Your standard bearer definitely matters. Public health advocates are very powerful, and we've had some great advocates at the local level and the state level who've been engaging on the issue. Also, hunger and low-income advocates, you gotta reach out to them because they will really hurt you if you don't have their support. And that's something that I've begun doing myself just personally with some national organizations, just because they are really, I mean, they care so much about the same constituency that we care about. And so there's a lot of potential for collaboration. So it's really something to look at. And remember, you need to go to these people first before the bill gets dropped. Medical professionals are extremely powerful advocates on this issue. In Philadelphia, testifying before the city council, we had doctors testifying, and pediatricians especially. They really have a lot of credibility with legislators and policymakers. You listen to what your doctor says. And then the faith community is very important. Again, reaching out to these folks ahead of time. The Seventh-day Adventists are all about healthy eating, healthy lifestyles. I know that in Philadelphia, around the Clean Indoor Air Law, the Seventh-day Adventists played a very important role in convincing the mayor to sign that bill. So the faith community is really important. Again, it gives you a lot of depth, gives you a lot of breadth, opens it up to a lot of folks that aren't necessarily just talking about public health all the time, but who are very credible and have a powerful voice. To make this point about your standard bearer and its importance, I'm gonna give props to the Heart Association. In the DC poll, we asked the same question, and we included the American Heart Association as like essentially saying this was true. And what you found was 73% of voters, you found more voters agreeing with the state, or finding that the argument being convincing if the American Heart Association was making it. So it's really important for organizations like the American Heart Association to continue their push, and other organizations with these kinds of really respectable brands to continue to join the fight. So with that, I'll finish early and just say this is my contact information if you have any questions. Thanks.
So in today's slides, we've seen the soaring rates of obesity in this country. And we need to address the obesity epidemic now. It's urgent. We've got to look at multiple strategies that incentivize eating healthier fruits and vegetables and drinking healthier beverages, but we also have to look at disincentives that that reduce the consumption of unhealthy foods and unhealthy beverages. Research has shown that drinking sugary beverages had the strongest link with overweight and obesity, more than any other food-related behavior in this country. Sugar-sweetened beverage taxes offer tremendous potential for public health. So I'd like to thank today's panel for their contributions to this cutting-edge policy area, but I'd also like to thank this panel even more so for the courageous commitment that they have done in this area. And so with that, I'd like to open this up for questions and answers. Let's start back there. I'm sorry, could you actually speak up?
There's about a 10-year growing body of evidence that diet pop makes you fat. And if we don't include those artificial sweeteners in this legislation, are we sending a message that those products are okay? People will just be switching from using those products, using the sugar products, to using the artificial sweeteners. And about 2 years ago, Baylor released a huge study where they followed two groups, the pop drinkers who had sugar and those who had the artificial sweeteners, for 8 years. And there was a 2.5 increase in obesity rate. I mean, both groups got fat, okay? But those that were using the diet pop were 2.5 times at a higher rate of obesity. And again, every month, those studies coming out looking at animals with aspartame and sucralose and saccharin. As to that these things are not any better in terms of the outcomes. And are we going to be back here 10 years from now asking about taxes on those products if we don't include them? And of course, my big issue with this is, are we sending a message by just putting it on the sugar pop that the artificial sweeteners
We've debated a lot about this ourselves, about whether to include the diet drinks, artificially sweetened drinks, in the tax proposals. And we decided not to because our reading of the literature is a little bit different than yours, and that it seems like to us that there are two big issues with these. One is the safety of the sweeteners, and then the second is whether they help people control their weight. And we just believe that the evidence on both of those issues was not definitive enough to take a stand to say that they should be taxed. And with something as radical, as a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, we wanted to be on very solid scientific ground. There's no question about that with the sugar-sweetened beverages, a little less clear with the artificially sweetened beverages. So I have great concern about the diet beverages myself, but my reading of the literature is that it's still mixed at the moment.
Can I add to that?
Sure,
Andrew. So from a political perspective, we had Nancy Che in D.C. was looking at including diet beverages in the tax, and within 3 days, she dropped it. It's politically, as Mr. Kelly said, it's just really, this is a big change to tax sugary drinks, and the more you add to that, the more difficult it becomes. So.
Thanks, Andrew. Right here?
Hi, I'm Steve Nowski, pediatric and public health from Knoxville area in the Indian Health Service. I have a question that is sort of addresses all four of you. Are there any economic models and or advocacy models where people have looked at employment opportunities that are blocked by incorporating a sugar-sweetened beverage tax? On Knoxville area, we have a distributor and bottler, but they're a large employer in our population where we have very few other job resources. And I need to know whether there are models for advocating drafting legislation where you can put some of the money into economic development as opposed to obesity prevention exercises, and if there are any models for that, it would be very helpful for us as we move forward in our efforts.
Anybody?
I'll take the first stab at that one. There aren't any good economic data at this point on what the impact, employment impact or economic impact would be of the sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. We have a project that's just about to get started to do exactly that. There is, a parallel that can be drawn to tobacco. So the same argument was made around tobacco excise taxes for decades, still made in a lot of other countries around the world. And the basic idea is that if you raise taxes, you're going to put all the tobacco farmers out of work, you're going to put all the tobacco product manufacturers out of work, and you're going to cost the economy lots of jobs. So there's a grain of truth to that. I mean, you will have some impact on the sector that's producing those products. But at the same time, the money that people were spending on tobacco products didn't disappear from the economy. It goes back. People start buying other goods and services. Government gets the tax revenues. They use that to reinvest in different projects that typically are going to be more labor intensive. So with tobacco taxes, we saw a net increase in employment across the country. The only places where you would have seen any decrease would have been in the really heavy tobacco farming areas. And that's really something that's not even true anymore today. When it comes to the beverage industry, I think it's even a little bit different. I mean, I think there will be exactly the sort of substitution that was talked about before. People are going to stop consuming the sugary beverages. They're going to consume other beverages. They're produced by the same bottlers and distributors in a lot of cases. So it's not going to have the same sort of employment impact there. And if the money that's generated from the tax, again, gets put back into projects that are going to be aimed at reducing obesity, those are going to tend to be more labor intensive as well. So you're probably going to see the same sort of net positive impact on jobs. There's almost certainly going to be no negative impact, but probably a positive impact. And then I think the other issue that you raise is this whole issue about then what happens to the revenues and how do you deal with some of the harmful impact that happens as a result of it. So to the extent that there would be a negative impact for a certain bottler, there may be ways of then, like you said, reinvesting some of those funds in redevelopment, training opportunities there. The argument comes up all the time about the regressive impact of taxes, and it's the same thing. First of all, the public health impact is really regressive. But to the extent that you can take the revenues that are generated from the tax, put them back into things like subsidizing fruit and vegetable or other things that are specifically targeting the groups that are most concerned, you can offset some of those arguments as well.
Thanks, Ryan.
Other brief point, like I said during my presentation, from a legal standpoint, you can dedicate those funds, the proceeds, in almost any way that you want. There's almost no limit. So if you want to try and dedicate some of those funds to forestall some of those arguments that you're hearing know, that's a possibility from a legal standpoint. It's just figuring out what those, how to dedicate them in that manner.
Great. There's a gentleman in the back.
Yeah, my question has to do with the advocacy chain of events and the way you can go forward to be most effective strategy. I'm from New Jersey, and when a state legislator introduced the bill to ban trans fats, she got death threats in her office. And really, she got way ahead of the rest of the community. It was a good idea they were doing in New York, just didn't seem to resonate very well in New Jersey. And knowing that if the committee begin to talk about this, the beverage people are going to come out with their ads and put a ton of money into it. Is there a best practice for your advocacy campaign before you go to the legislature to try to really prepare the ground in such a way that you're going to be more likely to be successful?
Yes, there is. as you aptly note, I think certain elected officials, certain policymakers have actually gotten ahead of us as advocates. We saw that this year. I read about the Mayor Nutter's, I know Mayor Nutter's been working with some folks, but I read about his proposal in the newspaper and called up his health department. I mean, I think that we now know that we need to do more around this issue. And I think that's the missing piece, is that we've been playing catch up in 2010. There's a real need to lay the foundation right now. And you can use the lessons learned from the tobacco movement. You can use any sort of grassroots policy change model. And there's a lot of parallels here. I mean, we saw them already. We saw it in DC with the really broad coalition providing a lot more support. We saw it in, we saw effective lobbying tactics really yielding results in Philadelphia. So there's a lot of lessons out there we can capitalize on. It's a matter of just doing the work ahead of time before the proposals are introduced.
Sure. So actually, Kelly, I'm going to add one more thing, too. So as a person that's done grassroots organizing before coming to the foundation and also working to develop programs around advocacy, I would say, sir, absolutely, there are best practices around doing advocacy. First and foremost, I think one of the worst possible situations is for an elected and appointed official to get out in front of the folks on the ground. And that really speaks to all of the groundwork that needs to happen in terms of coalition building, making sure that folks that represent some of the constituencies that Andrew talked about are at the table having the conversation. You're talking about deal breakers, you're talking about positive effects and also negative consequences, and really hashing out all of that sort of behind the scenes before everything goes public. And there are tremendous examples both in the environment world as well as right here, here in the public health world. So, Kelly.
And one other specific thing, this got recommended to me by the health commissioner in one of the states where they'd considered a sugar sweetened beverage tax, and he suggested doing a poll before the tax gets introduced, and the soda companies have had an opportunity to come in and do their barrage of anti-tax messaging. And that could be very helpful. And then, of course, as Andrew said, the way the questions are framed within the poll can really affect the number of people who support the tax.
So I saw a lot of hands. I'm going to go to this gentleman here, and I'm keeping an eye out for folks.
I think all of us could answer that, especially the other. No, I mean, they're spending incredible amounts of money to lobby against this. And I think the reason is that one thing that surprised me is that other companies, other parts of the food industry, haven't supported the soda companies in fighting this, because if they were smart enough, they'd see that they're next. but they haven't done that. So it's really the sugar beverage companies that are sort of out there on their own. So I'm, but no, I've seen no sign at all that they're coming around to embrace this kind of an idea.
So the implication is their rhetoric is bullshit.
Well, I mean, if you, I think there are empirical ways to test whether their talk about supporting public health is true. One can look at marketing practices, what specific things are being sold internationally, not just in the U.S., whether their self-regulatory pledges have been fulfilled. I think there are a lot of ways to actually get numbers, put numbers to these things. And what I've seen so far is not very impressive. I'm, you know, they talk a good game, but I don't know that that leads to much change.
Girl in the orange sweater.
Jim, do you want to answer that?
We've got Jim Krieger here from the Seattle King County Department of Health.
Can I just add, so I would just say, to sum that up, Jim did a great job explaining that, just in a simple statement, that has, that repeal has nothing to do with the public support for sugars and beverage excise tax. It was not focused on public health, there was no message around public health supporting it, it was on a bunch of products, it was a revenue raiser, so I think advocates need to know that the public won't necessarily repeal these things. This ballot initiative is a completely different issue.
Great, thanks. So we have time for a couple more questions, and I saw someone in the front row.
Just a comment, observation question around maybe some research variables to think about. I'm from Michigan, and I was astonished in my grocery store parking lot in recent weeks to find families dumping soda down the drain for the value of the can, the 10-cent can. They were using their food stamp packages to buy up as many soda products as they could for the cash value of the returnables. So looking at state variables in terms of 5-cent, 10-cent, I don't know whether that's really in play or not, but it was just astonishing to me. And the other thing that might speak to advocacy is thinking about how the environmental agencies got those refundable returns in place in those states already. Those were typically excise taxes levied against bottlers, distributors. So thinking about how that worked or didn't work in those states might be of value.
Thank you. And with that, I see one last question in the back.
Yeah, George and Taylor. Thank you. guys are going to, you're not going to pay more for your soil, you're going to pay more for everything else, because eventually the vendor is going to be taxed in that sense. So there's no evidence that actually is going to happen. It's bad economics 101 being applied, you're going to spear tax. But so have you seen in your other states that you've been working on these two types of things go on, and how, were there any successful ways of approaching those two problems, those two kind of prongs of the test?
So, yes, we've seen that same argument, the jobs argument. I know that the industry has done extensive polling and focus group research, and clearly during a recession, that's a very powerful argument. Whether or not there's any veracity behind it, it's a good argument. I think that we heard earlier some good counters to the economic the economic argument, the jobs argument. There's substitution. There are all these other spending from the funds that are created, and there's no evidence. There's no evidence to date that any jobs will be lost from this. So I guess where's the factual basis for it? But we weren't surprised at all that they used that. What we tried to do, and then these other arguments you mentioned, what we tried to do is just keep it really focused on the positive, which is this is about fighting childhood obesity. 90% of the people believe this is a big problem. There's clearly, this is research evidence-based intervention. This is research evidence-based intervention that works. And so by keeping it focused on that, and then rebutting, the economic arguments simultaneously, that's the tack you took. The bottom line is, the more this issue becomes normalized, the worse it is going to be for the industry. The more that we engage, even if we're losing, the better it is going to be down the road, because we're continuing to build momentum. The earned media is beginning to pay much more attention to this, and you're starting to get policymakers coming out of the woodwork proposing with their own proposals. So even though there's some powerful arguments against it that have worked so far, we should not relent.
So with that, please join me in thanking our panel.